tribute. And yet the puzzle remained not only as to why he didn't, but as to why, if he didn't, he hadn't written me about it in the first place. I could only conclude, given what I now knew of this life, neither overly rich in contrasts, nor troubled too much by contradiction, that the letter and its contents had to do with the operation, with something uncharacteristic that arose in him afterward, some surprising new emotion that had come to the fore. Yes, I thought, the letter grew out of Sweetlova's belated discovery of what it means to be not healthy but sick, to be not strong but weak, what it means to not look great, what physical shame is, what humiliation is, what the gruesome is, what extinction is, what it is like to ask why. Betrayed all at once by a wonderful body that had furnished him only with assurance and had constituted the bulk of his advantage over others, he had momentarily lost his equilibrium and had clutched at me, of all people, as a means of grasping his dead father and calling up the father's power to protect him. For a moment, his nerve was shattered, and this man, who, as far as I could tell, used himself mainly to conceal himself, had been transformed into an impulsive, devitalized being in dire need of a blessing. Death had burst into the dream of his life, as for the second time in 10 years it had burst into mine, and the things that disquiet men our age disquieted even him. I wondered if he was willing any longer to recall the sickbed vulnerability that had made certain inevitabilities as real for him as the exterior of his family's life, to remember the shadow that had insinuated itself like a virulent icing between the layers and layers of contentment. Yet, he showed up for our dinner date. Did that mean the unendurable wasn't blotted out? The safeguards weren't back in place? The emergency wasn't yet over? Or was showing up and going blindly on about everything that was endurable his way of purging the last of his fears? The more I thought about this simple-seeming soul sitting across from me eating zabouillon and exuding sincerity, the farther from him my thinking carried me. The man within the man was scarcely perceptible to me. I couldn't make sense of him. I couldn't imagine him at all, having come down with my own strain of the Swede's disorder. The inability to draw conclusions about anything but exteriors. Rooting around trying to figure this guy out is ridiculous, I told myself. This is the jar you can't open. This guy can't be cracked by thinking. That's the mystery of his mystery. It's like trying to get something out of Michelangelo's David. I'd given him my number in my letter. Why hadn't he called to break the date if he was no longer deformed by the prospect of death? Once it was all back to how it had always been, once he recovered that special luminosity that had never failed to win whatever he wanted, what use did he have for me? No. His letter, I thought, can't be the whole story. If it were, he wouldn't have come. Something remains of the rash urge to change things. Something that overtook him in the hospital is still there. An unexamined existence no longer serves his needs. He wants something recorded. That's why he's turned to me. To record what might otherwise be forgotten. Omitted and forgotten. What could it be? Or maybe he was just a happy man. Happy people exist too. Why shouldn't they? All this scattershot speculation about the Swede's motives was only my professional impatience, my trying to imbue Sweetlova with something like the tendentious meaning Tolstoy assigned to Ivan Ilyich, so belittled by the author in the uncharitable story in which he sets out to heartlessly expose in clinical terms what it is to be ordinary. Ivan Ilyich is the well-placed high court official who leads a decorous life approved of by society, and who, on his deathbed, in the depths of his unceasing agony and terror, thinks, maybe I did not live as I ought to have done. Ivan Ilyich's life, writes Tolstoy, summarizing right at the outset, his judgment of the presiding judge, with the delightful St. Petersburg house and a handsome salary of 3,000 rubles a year, and friends all of a good social position, had been most simple and most ordinary, and therefore most terrible. Maybe so. Maybe in Russia in 1886, but in old Rimbrock, New Jersey in 1995, When the Ivan Ilyiches come trooping back to lunch at the clubhouse after their morning round of golf and start to crow, "It doesn't get any better than this." They may be a lot closer to the truth than Leo Tolstoy ever was. Sweet Lvov's life, for all I knew, had been most simple and most ordinary, and therefore just great, right in the American grain. "Is Jerry gay?" I suddenly asked. "My brother?" The Swede laughed. "You're kidding." Maybe I was, and had asked the question out of mischief, to alleviate the boredom. Yet I did happen to be remembering that line the Swede had written me about how much his father had suffered because of the shocks that befell his loved ones, which led me to wondering again what he had been alluding to, which spontaneously reminded me of the humiliation Jerry had brought upon himself in our junior year of high school when he attempted to win the heart of a strikingly unexceptional girl in our class, who you wouldn't have thought required a production to get her to kiss you. As a Valentine present, Jerry made a coat for her out of hamster skins, 175 hamster skins that he cured in the sun and then sewed together with a curved sewing needle pilfered from his father's factory, where the idea dawned on him. The high school biology department had been given a gift of some 300 hamsters for the purpose of dissection, and Jerry diligently finagled to collect the skins from the biology students. His oddness and his genius made credible the story he told about a scientific experiment he was conducting at home. He finagled next to find out the girl's height. He designed a pattern, and then, after he got most of the stink out of the hides, or thought he had, by drying them in the sun on the roof of his garage, he meticulously sewed the skins together, finishing the coat off with a silk lining made out of a section of a white parachute, an imperfect parachute his brother had sent home to him as a memento from the Marine Air Base in Cherry Point, North Carolina, where the Parris Island team won the last game of the season for the Marine Corps Baseball Championship. The only person Jerry told about the coat was me, the ping-pong stooge. He was going to send it to the girl in a Bamberger's coat box of his mother's, wrapped in lavender tissue paper and tied with velvet ribbon. But when the coat was finished, it was so stiff, because of the idiotic way he dried the skins, his father would later explain, that he couldn't get it to fold up in the box. Across from the Swede, in Vincent's restaurant, I suddenly recall seeing it in the basement, this big thing sitting on the floor with sleeves. Today, I was thinking, it would win all kinds of prizes at the Whitney Museum, but back in Newark in 1949, nobody knew dick about what great art was, and Jerry and I racked our brains trying to figure out what he could do to get the coat into the box. He was set on that box because she would think, when she began to open it, that it contained an expensive coat from BAMS. I was thinking of what she would think when she saw that wasn't what it contained. I was thinking that surely it didn't take such hard work to gain the attention of a chubby girl with bad skin and no boyfriend. But I cooperated with Jerry because he had a cyclonic personality you either fled or yielded to, and because he was Swede Lvov's brother, and I was in Swede Lvov's house, and everywhere you looked was Swede Lvov's trophies. Eventually, Jerry tore the entire coat apart and re-sewed it so that the stitching lay straight across the chest, creating a hinge of sorts where the coat could be bent and placed in the box. I helped him. It was like sewing a suit of armor. Atop the coat, he placed a heart that he cut out of cardboard and painted his name on it in Gothic letters, and the package was sent parcel post. It had taken him 3 months to transform an improbable idea into nutty reality, brief by human standards. She screamed when she opened the box. "She had a fit," her girlfriend said. Jerry's father also had a fit. "This is what you do with the parachute your brother sent you? You cut it up? You cut up a parachute?" Jerry was too humiliated to tell him that it was to get the girl to fall into his arms and kiss him the way Lana Turner kissed Clark Gable. I happened to be there when his father went after him for curing the skins in the midday sun. A skin must be preserved properly. Properly. And properly is not in the sun. You must dry a skin in the shade. You don't want them sunburned, damn it. Can I teach you once and for all, Jerome, how to preserve a skin? And that he proceeded to do. In a boil at first, barely able to contain his frustration with his own son's ineptitude as a leather worker, explaining to both of us what they had taught the traders to do to the sheepskins in Ethiopia before they shipped them to Newark Maid to be contracted out to the tanner. You can salt it, but salt's expensive. Especially in Africa. Very, very expensive. They steal the salt there. These people don't have salt. You have to put poison into the salt over there so they won't steal it. Other way is to pack the skin up various ways, either on a board or on a frame. You tie it and make little cuts. Tie it up and dry it in the shade. In the shade, boys. That's what we call flint-dried skin. Sprinkle a little flint on it, keeps it from deteriorating, prevents the bugs from entering. Much to my own relief, the outrage had given way surprisingly fast to a patient, if tedious, pedagogical assault, which seemed to gall Jerry even more than being blown down by his father's huffing and puffing. It could well have been that very day when Jerry swore to himself never to go near his father's business. To deal with malodorous skins, Jerry had doused the coat with his mother's perfume, but by the time the coat was delivered by the postman, it had begun to stink as it had intermittently all along, and the girl was so revolted when she opened the box, so insulted and horrified, that she never spoke to Jerry again. According to the other girls, she thought he had gone out and hunted and killed all those tiny beasts and then sent them to her because of her blemished skin. Jerry was in a rage when he got the news, and in the midst of our next ping-pong game, cursed her and called all girls fucking idiots. If he hadn't before had the courage to ask anyone out on a date, he never tried after that, and was one of only three boys who didn't show up at the senior prom. The other two were what we identified as sissies. And that was why I now asked the sweet a question about Jerry that I would never have dreamed of asking in 1949, when I had no clear idea what a homosexual was and couldn't imagine that anybody I knew could be one. At the time, I thought Jerry was Jerry, a genius with obsessive naivete and colossal innocence about girls. In those days, that explained it all. Maybe it still does, but I was really looking to see what, if anything, could roil the innocence of this regal Swede, and to prevent myself from being so rude as to fall asleep on him, so I asked him, "Is Jerry gay?" "As a kid, there was always something secretive about Jerry," I said. "There were never any girls, never close friends, always something about him, even besides his brains, that set him apart." The Swede nodded, looking at me as though he understood my deeper meaning as no human being ever had before. And because of this probing stare that I would swear saw nothing, all this giving that gave nothing and gave away nothing, I had no idea where his thoughts might be, or even if he had thoughts. When, momentarily, I stopped speaking, I sensed that my words, rather than falling into the net of the other person's awareness, got linked up with nothing in his brain, went in there, and vanished. Something about the harmless eyes, the promise they made that he could never do anything other than what was right, was becoming annoying to me, which has to be why I next brought up his letter instead of keeping my mouth shut until the bill came and I could get away from him for another 50 years, so that when 2045 rolled around, I might actually look forward to seeing him again. You fight your superficiality, your shallowness, so as to try to come at people without unreal expectations, without an overload of bias or hope or arrogance, as untank-like as you can be. Sans cannon and machine guns and steel plating half a foot thick. You come at them unmenacingly on your own 10 toes instead of tearing up the turf with your caterpillar treads. Take them on with an open mind, as equals, man to man, as we used to say, and yet you never fail to get them wrong. You might as well have the brain of a tank. You get them wrong before you meet them, while you're anticipating meeting them, you get them wrong while you're with them, and then you go home to tell somebody else about the meeting and you get them all wrong again. Since the same generally goes for them with you, the whole thing is really a dazzling illusion empty of all perception, an astonishing farce of misperception. And yet, what are we to do about this terribly significant business of other people, which gets bled of the significance we think it has and takes on instead a significance that is ludicrous? So ill-equipped are we all to envision one another's interior workings and invisible aims. Is everyone to go off and lock the door and sit secluded like the lonely writers do? In a soundproof cell, summoning people out of words and then proposing that these word people are closer to the real thing than the real people that we mangle with our ignorance every day? The fact remains that getting people right is not what living is all about anyway. It's getting them wrong that is living. Getting them wrong and wrong and wrong, and then, on careful reconsideration, getting them wrong again. That's how we know we're alive. We're wrong. Maybe the best thing would be to forget being right or wrong about people and just go along for the ride. But if you can do that, well, lucky you. When you wrote me about your father and the shocks he suffered, it occurred to me that maybe Jerry had been the shock. Your old man wouldn't have been any better than mine at coming to grips with a queer son. The sweet smile, the smile that refused to be superior. That was meant to reassure me that nothing in him ever could or would want to resist me. That signaled to me that, adored as he was no better than me, even perhaps a bit of a nobody beside me. Well, fortunately for my father, he didn't have to. Jerry was the son, the doctor. He couldn't have been prouder of anyone than he was of Jerry. Jerry's a physician? In Miami. Cardiac surgeon, $1 million a year. Married? Jerry married? The smile again. The vulnerability in that smile was the surprising element. The vulnerability of our record-breaking muscleman faced with all the crudeness it takes to stay alive. The smile's refusal to recognize, let alone to sanction in himself, the savage obstinacy that 7 decades of surviving requires of a man. As though anyone over 10 believes you can subjugate with a smile. Even one that kind and warm, all the things that are out to get you. With a smile, hold it all together when the strong arm of the unforeseen comes crashing down on your head. Once again, I began to think that he might be mentally unsound, that this smile could perhaps be an indication of derangement. There was no sham in it, and that was the worst of it. The smile wasn't insincere. He wasn't imitating anything. This caricature was it, arrived at spontaneously after a lifetime of working himself deeper and deeper into what? The idea of himself neighborhood stardom had wreathed him in, had that mummified the sweet as a boy forever? It was as though he had abolished from his world everything that didn't suit him. Not only deceit, violence, mockery, and ruthlessness, but anything remotely coarse-grained, any threat of contingency, that dreadful harbinger of helplessness. Not for a second did he stop trying to make his relation to me appear as simple and sincere as the seeming relationship to himself. Unless he was just a mature man, as devious as the next mature man. Unless what was awakened by the cancer surgery, and what had momentarily managed to penetrate a lifelong comfy take on things, the 100% recovery had all but extinguished. Unless he was not a character with no character to reveal, but a character with none that he wished to reveal. Just a sensible man who understands that if you regard highly your privacy and the well-being of your loved ones, the last person to take into your confidence is a working novelist. Give the novelist, instead of your life story, the brazen refusal of the gorgeous smile, blast him with the stun gun of your Prince of Blandness smile, then polish off the Zabaglione and get the hell back to old Rimrock, New Jersey, where your life is your business, not his. Jerry's been married 4 times, said the sweet, smiling. Family record. And you? I'd already figured, from the ages of his 3 boys, that the 40-ish blonde with the golf clubs was more than likely a second wife, and perhaps a third. Yet divorce didn't fit my picture of someone who so refused to register life's irrational element. If there had been a divorce, it had to have been initiated by Miss New Jersey. Or she had died. Or, being married to someone who had to keep the achievement looking perfect, someone devoted heart and soul to the illusion of stability, had led her to suicide. Maybe that was the shock that had befallen. Perversely, my attempts to come up with the missing piece that would make the Swede whole and coherent kept identifying him with disorders of which there was no trace on his beautifully aging paragon's face. I couldn't decide if that blankness of his was like snow covering something or snow covering nothing. Me, two wives, that's my limit. I'm a piker next to my brother. His new one's in her 30s, half his age. Jerry's the doctor who marries the nurse. All four nurses. They revere the ground Dr. Lvov walks on. Four wives, six kids. That drove my dad a little nuts. But Jerry's a big guy, a gruff guy, the high and mighty prima donna surgeon. Got a whole hospital by the short hairs. And so even my dad fell in line. Had to. Would have lost him otherwise. My kid brother doesn't screw around. Dad kicked and screamed through each divorce, wanted to shoot Jerry 100 times over, but as soon as Jerry remarried, the new wife, in my father's eyes, was more of a princess than the wife before. She's a doll. She's a sweetheart. She's my girl. Anybody said anything about any of Jerry's wives, my father would have murdered him. Jerry's kids, he outright adored. 5 girls, 1 boy. My dad loved the boy, but the girls, they were the apple of his eye. There's nothing he wouldn't do for those kids, for any of our kids. When he had everybody around him, all of us, all the kids, my old man was in heaven. 96, never sick a day in his life. After the stroke, for the 6 months before he died, that was the worst. But he had a good run, had a good life. Real fighter, force of nature. Unstoppable guy. A light, floating tone to the words when he goes off on the subject of his father, the voice resonant with amorous reverence, disclosing unashamedly that nothing had permeated more of his life than his father's expectations. The suffering? Could have been a lot worse, the Swede said. Just the 6 months, and even then he didn't know half the time what was going on. He just slipped away one night, and we lost him. By suffering, I had meant that suffering he had referred to in his letter, provoked in his father by the shocks that befell his loved ones. But even if I had thought to bring the letter with me and had rattled it in his face, the Swede would have eluded his own writing as effortlessly as he'd shaken off his tacklers on that Saturday 50 years before, at City Stadium against Southside, our weakest rival, and set a state record by scoring 4 times on consecutive pass plays. Of course, I thought, of course. My urge to discover substratum, my continuing suspicion that more was there than what I was looking at, aroused in him the fear that I might go ahead and tell him that he wasn't what he wanted us to believe he was. But then I thought, why bestow on him all this thinking? Why the appetite to know this guy? Ravenous, because once upon a time he said to you, and to you alone, basketball was never like this, Skip. Why clutch at him? What's the matter with you? There's nothing here but what you're looking at. He's all about being looked at. He always was. He's not faking all this virginity. You're craving depths that don't exist. This guy is the embodiment of nothing. I was wrong. Never more mistaken about anyone in my life. Let's remember the energy. Americans were governing not only themselves, but some 200 million people in Italy, Austria, Germany, and Japan. The war crimes trials were cleansing the earth of its devils once and for all. Atomic power was ours alone. Rationing was ending. Price controls were being lifted. In an explosion of self-assertion, auto workers, coal workers, transit workers, maritime workers, steel workers, laborers by the millions demanded more and went on strike for it. And playing Sunday morning softball on the Chancellor Avenue field and pickup basketball on the asphalt courts behind the school were all the boys who had come back alive. Neighbors, cousins, older brothers, their pockets full of separation pay, the GI Bill inviting them to break out in ways they could not have imagined possible before the war. Our class started high school 6 months after the unconditional surrender of the Japanese, during the greatest moment of collective inebriation in American history.
and the upsurge of energy was contagious. Around us, nothing was lifeless. Sacrifice and constraint were over. The depression had disappeared. Everything was in motion. The lid was off. Americans were to start over again en masse, everyone in it together. If that wasn't sufficiently inspiring, the miraculous conclusion of this towering event, the clock of history reset and a whole people's aims limited no longer by the past, there was the neighborhood, the communal determination that we, the children, should escape poverty, ignorance, disease, social injury and intimidation, escape, above all, insignificance. You must not come to nothing. Make something of yourselves. Despite the undercurrent of anxiety, a sense communicated daily that hardship was a persistent menace that only persistent diligence could hope to keep at bay, despite a generalized mistrust of the Gentile world, despite the fear of being battered that clung to many families because of the Depression, ours was not a neighborhood steeped in darkness. The place was bright with industriousness. There was a big belief in life, and we were steered relentlessly in the direction of success. A better existence was going to be ours. The goal was to have goals. The aim was to have aims. This edict came entangled, often in hysteria, the embattled hysteria of those whom experience had taught how little antagonism it takes to wreck a life beyond repair. Yet it was this edict, emotionally overloaded as it was by the uncertainty in our elders, by their awareness of all that was in league against them, that made the neighborhood a cohesive place. A whole community perpetually imploring us not to be immoderate and screw up. Imploring us to grasp opportunity, exploit our advantages, remember what matters. The shift wasn't slight between the generations, and there was plenty to argue about. The ideas of the world they wouldn't give up, the rules they worship, for us rendered all but toothless by the passage of just a couple of decades of American time. Those uncertainties that were theirs, and not ours. The question of how free of them we might dare to be was ongoing. An internal debate, ambivalent and exasperated. What was most cramping in their point of view, a few of us did find the audacity to strain against, but the intergenerational conflict never looked like it would 20 years later. The neighborhood was never a field of battle strewn with the bodies of the misunderstood. There was plenty of haranguing to ensure obedience. The adolescent capacity for upheaval was held in check by 1,000 requirements, stipulations, prohibitions, restraints that proved insuperable. One was our own highly realistic appraisal of what was most in our interest. Another, the pervasive rectitude of the era whose taboos we'd taken between our teeth at birth. Not least was the enacted ideology of parental self-sacrifice that bled us of wanton rebelliousness and sent underground almost every indecent urge. It would have taken a lot more courage, or foolishness, than most of us could muster to disappoint their passionate, unflagging illusions about our perfectibility and roam very far from the permissible. Their reasons for asking us to be both law-abiding and superior were not reasons we could find a conscience to discount. And so control that was close to absolute was ceded to adults who were striving and improving themselves through us. Mild forms of scarring may have resulted from this arrangement, but few cases of psychosis were reported, at least at the time. The weight of all that expectation was not necessarily killing, thank God. Of course, there were families where it might have helped if the parents had eased up a little on the break, but mostly the friction between generations was just sufficient to give us purchase to move forward. Am I wrong to think that we delighted in living there? No delusions are more familiar than those inspired in the elderly by nostalgia, but am I completely mistaken to think that living as well-born children in Renaissance Florence could not have held a candle to growing up within aromatic range of Tabachnik's pickle barrels? Am I mistaken to think that even back then, in the vivid present, the fullness of life stirred our emotions to an extraordinary extent? Has anywhere since so engrossed you in its ocean of details? The detail. The immensity of the detail. the force of the detail, the weight of the detail, the rich endlessness of detail surrounding you in your young life, like the 6 feet of dirt that will be packed on your grave when you're dead. Perhaps, by definition, a neighborhood is the place to which a child spontaneously gives undivided attention. That's the unfiltered way meaning comes to children, just flowing off the surface of things. Nonetheless, 50 years later, I ask you, has the immersion ever again been so complete as it was in those streets, where every block, every backyard, every house, every floor of every house, the walls, ceilings, doors, windows of every last friend's family apartment came to be so absolutely individualized? Were we ever again to be such keen recording instruments of the microscopic surface of things close at hand, of the minutest gradations of social position conveyed by linoleum and oilcloth, by yardside candles and cooking smells, by Ronson table lighters and Venetian blinds? About one another, we knew who had what kind of lunch in the bag in his locker and who ordered what on his hot dog at Sid's. We knew one another's every physical attribute, who walked pigeon-toed and who had breasts, who smelled of hair oil and who over-salivated when he spoke. We knew who among us was belligerent and who was friendly, who was smart and who was dumb. We knew whose mother had the accent and whose father had the mustache, whose mother worked and whose father was dead. Somehow, we even dimly grasped how every family's different set of circumstances set each family a distinctive, difficult human problem. And, of course, there was the mandatory turbulence, born of need, appetite, fantasy, longing, and the fear of disgrace, with only adolescent introspection to light the way. Each of us, hopelessly pubescent, alone and in secret, attempted to regulate it. And, in an era when chastity was still ascendant, a national cause to be embraced by the young like freedom and democracy. It's astonishing that everything so immediately visible in our lives as classmates, we still remember so precisely. The intensity of feeling that we have seeing one another today is also astonishing. But most astonishing is that we are nearing the age that our grandparents were when we first went off to be freshmen at the Annex on February 1st, 1946. What is astonishing is that we, who had no idea how anything was going to turn out, now know exactly what happened, that the results are in for the class of January 1950, the unanswerable questions answered, the future revealed. Is that not astonishing? To have lived, and in this country, and in our time, and as who we were. Astonishing. This is the speech I didn't give at my 45th high school reunion. A speech to myself, masked as a speech to them. I began to compose it only after the reunion, in the dark, in bed, groping to understand what had hit me. The tone, too ruminative for a country club ballroom, and the sort of good time people were looking for there, didn't seem at all ill-conceived between 3 and 6 a.m., as I tried, in my overstimulated state, to comprehend the union underlying the reunion, the common experience that had joined us as kids. Despite gradations of privation and privilege, despite the array of anxieties fostered by an impressively nuanced miscellany of family quarrels, quarrels that fortunately promised more unhappiness than they always delivered, something powerful united us. And united us not merely in where we came from, but in where we were going and how we would get there. We had new means and new ends, new allegiances and new aims, new innards, new ease. Somewhat less agitation in facing down the exclusions the Goyim still wished to preserve. And out of what context did these transformations arise? Out of what historical drama acted unsuspectingly by its little protagonists, played out in classrooms and kitchens, looking nothing at all like the great theater of life? Just what collided with what to produce the spark in us? I was still awake and all stirred up, formulating these questions and their answers in my bed, blurry, insomniac shadows of these questions and their answers, some 8 hours after I'd driven back from New Jersey, where, on a sunny Sunday late in October, at a country club in a Jewish suburb, far from the futility prevailing in the streets of our crime-ridden, drug-infested childhood home, the reunion that began at 11 in the morning went ebulliently on all afternoon long. It was held in a ballroom just at the edge of the country club's golf course for a group of elderly adults who, as Wikwaya kids of the 30s and 40s, would have thought a niblick, which was what in those days they called the nine iron, was a hunk of schmaltz herring. Now, I couldn't sleep. The last thing I could remember was the parking valet bringing my car around to the steps of the portico and the reunion's commander-in-chief, Selmore Breslov, kindly asking if I had a good time, and my telling her, "It's like going out to your old outfit after Iwo Jima." Around 3 a.m., I left my bed and went to my desk, my head vibrant with the static of unelaborated thought. I wound up working there until 6, by which time I got the reunion speech to read as it appears above. Only after I'd built to the emotional peroration culminating in the word astonishing, was I at last sufficiently unastonished by the force of my feelings to be able to put together a couple of hours of sleep, or something resembling sleep, for even half out of it, I was a biography in perpetual motion, memory to the marrow of my bones. Yes, even from as benign a celebration as a high school reunion, it's not so simple to instantaneously resume existence back behind the blindfold of continuity and routine. Perhaps if I was 30 or 40, the reunion would have faded sweetly away in the 3 hours it took me to drive home. But there's no easy mastery of such events at 62, and only a year beyond cancer surgery. Instead of recapturing time past, I'd been captured by it in the present. So that passing seemingly out of the world of time, I was, in fact, rocketing through to its secret core. For the hours we were all together, doing nothing more than hugging, kissing, kibitzing, laughing, hovering over one another, recollecting the dilemmas and disasters that hadn't in the long run made a damn bit of difference, crying out, "Look who's here," and, "Oh, it's been a long time," and, "You remember me? I remember you," asking each other, "Didn't we once... Were you the kid who..." Commanding one another with those three poignant words I heard people repeat all afternoon as they were drawn and tugged into numerous conversations at once. "Don't go away." And of course, dancing cheek to cheek, dancing our outdated dance steps to a one-man band. A bearded boy in a tuxedo, his brow encircled with a red bandana. A boy born at least 2 full decades after we marched together out of the school auditorium to the rousing recessional tempo of Iolanthe, accompanying himself on a synthesizer as he imitated Nat King Cole, Frankie Lane, and Sinatra. For those few hours' time, the chain of time, the whole damn drift of everything called time, had seemed as easy to understand as the dimensions of the donut you effortlessly down with your morning coffee. The one-man band in the bandana played Mule Train, while I thought, "The angel of time is passing over us and breathing with each breath all that we've lived through. The angel of time unmistakably is present in the ballroom of the Cedar Hill Country Club as the kid doing Mule Train like Frankie Lane." Sometimes I found myself looking at everyone as though it was still 1950, as though 1995 were merely the futuristic theme of a senior prom that we'd all come to in humorous papier-mâché masks of ourselves as we might look at the close of the 20th century. That afternoon, time had been invented for the mystification of no one but us. Inside the commemorative mug presented by Selma to each of us as we were departing were half a dozen little rugula in an orange tissue paper sack, neatly enclosed in orange cellophane and tied shut with striped curling ribbon of orange and brown, the school colors. The rugula, as fresh as any I'd ever snacked on at home after school, back then baked by the recipe broker of her Mahjong club, my mother, were a gift from one of our class members, a T-neck baker. Within 5 minutes of leaving the reunion, I'd undone the double wrapping and eaten all 6 rugula, each a snail of sugar-dusted pastry dough, the cinnamon-lined chambers microscopically studded with midget raisins and chopped walnuts. By rapidly devouring mouthful after mouthful of these crumbs, whose floury richness, splendid of butter and sour cream and vanilla and cream cheese and egg yolk and sugar, I love since childhood, perhaps I'd find vanishing from Nathan what, according to Proust, vanished from Marcel the instant he recognized the savor of the little Madeleine.
the apprehensiveness of death. A mere taste, Proust writes, and the word death has no meaning for him. So, greedily I ate, gluttonously, refusing to curtail for a moment this wolfish intake of saturated fat, but, in the end, having nothing like Marcel's luck. Let's speak further of death, and of the desire, understandably in the aging, a desperate desire, to forestall death, to resist it, to resort to whatever means are necessary to see death with anything, anything, anything but clarity. One of the boys up from Florida, according to the reunion booklet we each received at the door, 26 out of a graduating class of 176 were now living in Florida. A good sign. Meant we still had more people in Florida, 6 more, than we had who were dead. And all afternoon, by the way, it was not in my mind alone that the men would tag the boys and the women the girls. Told me that on the way to Livingston from Newark Airport, where his plane had landed and he rented a car, he twice had to pull up at a service station and get the key to the restroom, so racked was he by trepidation. This was Mendy Gerlich. In 1950, voted the handsomest boy in the class. In 1950, a broad-shouldered, long-lashed beauty, our most important jitterbugger, who loved to go around saying to people, "Solid, Jackson." Having once been invited by his older brother to a colored whorehouse on Augusta Street, where the pimps hung out, virtually around the corner from his father's Brantford Place liquor store, a whorehouse where, he eventually confessed, he sat fully clothed, waiting in an outer hallway flipping through a Mechanics Illustrated that he found on a table there, while his brother was the one who did it, Mendy was the closest the class had to a delinquent. It was Mendy Gerlich, now Gar, who'd taken me with him to the Adams Theater to hear Illinois Jacquette, Buddy Johnson, and Newark's own Sarah Vaughan, who'd got the tickets and taken me with him to hear Mr. B., Billy Eckstein, in concert at the Mosque, who in 49 had got tickets for us to the Miss Sepia America Beauty Contest at Laurel Garden. It was Mendy who, some 3 or 4 times, took me to watch broadcasting in the flesh Bill Cook, the smooth, late-night Negro disc jockey of the Jersey station WAAT musical Caravan. Bill Cook's show, I ordinarily listen to in my darkened bedroom on Saturday nights. The opening theme was Ellington's Caravan, very exotic, very sophisticated, Afro-Oriental rhythms, a belly-dancing beat. Just by itself it was worth tuning in for. Caravan, in the Duke's very own rendition, made me feel nicely illicit, even while tucked up between my mother's freshly laundered sheets. First the tom-tom opening, then winding curvaceously up out of the Kasbah, that great smoky trombone, and then the insinuating, snake-charming flute. Mendy called it boner music. To get to WAAT and Bill Cook's studio, we took the 14 bus downtown, and only minutes after we settled quietly like churchgoers in the row of chairs outside his glass-enclosed booth, Bill Cook would come out from behind the microphone to greet us, with a Race record spinning on the turntable, for listeners still unadventurously at home. Cookie would cordially shake the hands of the 2 tall, skinny white Sharpies, all done up in their one-button roll suits from the American shop and their shirts from the custom shop with the spread collars. The clothes on my back were on loan from Mendy for the night. "What might I play for you, gentlemen?" Cookie graciously inquired of us in a voice whose mellow resonance Mendy would imitate whenever we talked on the phone. I asked for the melodious stuff. Miss Dinah Washington. Miss Savannah Churchill. And how arresting that was back then, the salacious chivalry of the DJ's Miss. While Mendy's taste, spicier, racially far more authoritative, was for musicians like the lowdown saloon piano player of Roosevelt Sykes, for Ivory Joe Hunter. "When I lost my baby, I almost lost my mind." And for a quartet that Mendy seemed to me to take excessive pride in calling the Rayovacs, emphasizing the first syllable exactly as did the black kid from the South Side, Melvin Smith, who delivered for Mendy's father's store after school. Mendy and his brother did the Saturday deliveries.
Mendy boldly accompanied Melvin Smith one night to hear live bebop at the lounge over at the bowling alley on Beacon Street, Lloyd's Manor, a place to which few whites other than a musician's reckless Desdemona would venture. It was Mendy Gerlich who first took me down to the Radio Record Shack on Market Street, where we picked out bargains from the 19-cent bin and could listen to the record in a booth before we bought it. During the war, when, to keep up morale on the home front, there'd be dances one night a week during July and August at the Chancellor Avenue playground, Mendy used to scramble through the high-spirited crowd, neighborhood parents and school kids and little kids up late who ran gleefully round and round the painted white bases where we played our perpetual summer softball game, dispensing for whoever cared to listen a less conventional brand of musical pleasure than the Glenn Miller, Tommy Dorsey-inspired arrangement that most everybody else liked dancing to beneath the dim floodlights back of the school. Regardless of the dance tune the band up on the flag festoon bandstand happened to be playing, Mendy would race around most of the evening singing, "Caldonia, Caldonia, what makes your big head so hard? Rocks!" He sang it, as he blissfully proclaimed, free of charge. Just as nuttily as Louis Jordan and his Timpani Five did on the record he obliged all the daredevils to listen to whenever, for whatever refractory purpose, to play dollar limit seven-card stud, to examine for the millionth time the drawings in his Tilly the Toiler hot book, on rare occasions to hold a circle jerk, we entered his nefarious bedroom when nobody else was home. And here now was Mendy in 1995. The Wequake boy with the biggest talent for being less than a dignified model child, a personality halfway between mildly repellent shallowness and audacious, enviable deviance, flirting back then with indignity in a way that hovered continuously between the alluring and the offensive. Here was dapper, dirty, daffy Mendy Gerlich, not in prison, where I was certain he'd wind up when he'd urge us to sit in a circle on the floor of his bedroom some four or five daredevils with our pants pulled down, competing to win the couple of bucks in the pot by being the one to shoot first. Not in hell, where I was sure he'd be consigned after being stabbed to death at Lloyd's Manor by a colored guy high on reefer, whatever that meant, but simply a retired restaurateur, owner of three steakhouses called Gar's Grill in suburban Long Island, at no place more disreputable than his high school class's 45th reunion. "You shouldn't worry, man. You still got your build, your looks. You're amazing. You look great." He did, too. Well-tanned, slender, a tall, narrow-faced jogger, wearing black alligator boots and a black silk shirt beneath a green cashmere jacket. Only the head of brimming, silver-white hair looked suspiciously not quite his own, but as though it had had an earlier life as the end of a skunk. I take care of myself, that isn't my point. I call Moody. Marty Moody Sheffer. Star sidearm pitcher of the Daredevils. The team we three played on in the Playground Softball League, and, according to the biographical listing in the reunion booklet, a financial consultant, and, too, unlikely as it seemed when I remembered that paralyzingly shy of girls, babyface Moody had made pitching pennies his major adolescent diversion, progenitor of children, 36, 34, 31, grandchildren, 2, 1. "I told Moody," Mendy said, "that if he didn't sit next to me, I wasn't coming. I had to deal with the real goons in my business, dealt with the fucking mob, but this I could not deal with from day one. Not twice, Skip. 3 times I had to stop the car to take a crap." "Well," I said, "after years and years of painting ourselves opaque, this carries us straight back to when we were sure we were transparent. Is that it?" "Maybe. Who knows?" 20 kids dead in our class. He showed me at the back of the booklet the page headed In Memoriam. 11 of the guys dead, Mendy said. 2 from the Daredevils. Bert Bergman, Udi Orenstein. Udi was Moody's battery mate. Bert played second base. Prostate cancer, the both of them. And both in the last 3 years. I get the blood test. I get it every 6 months since I heard about Udi. You get the test? I get it. Of course, I didn't any longer because I no longer had a prostate. "How often?" "Every year." "Not enough," he told me. "Every 6 months." "Okay, I'll do that." "You been all right, though?" He asked, taking hold of me by the shoulders. I'm in good shape, I said. Hey, I taught you to jerk off, you know that? That you did, Mendel. Anywhere from 90 to 120 days before I would have happened upon it myself, you're the one who got me going. I'm the guy, he said, laughing loudly, who taught Skip Zuckerman to jerk off, my claim to fame. And we embraced, the ball first baseman and white-haired left fielder of the dwindling Daredevil Athletic Club. The torso I could feel through his clothes attested to just how well he did take care of himself.
I'm still at it, Mendy said happily. 50 years later, a daredevil record.
Don't be so sure, I said. Check with Moody. I heard you had a heart attack, he said. No, just a bypass, years ago.
A fucking bypass. They stick that tube down your throat, don't they?
They do. I saw my brother-in-law with that tube down his throat. That's all I need, Mendy said. I didn't want to be here in the worst fucking way, but Moody keeps calling and saying, you're not going to live forever, and I keep telling him, I am Mutt. I have to. Then I'm schmuck enough to come, and the first thing I see when I open up this booklet is obituaries.
When Mendy went off to get a drink and find Moody, I looked for his name in the booklet. Retired restaurateur. Children, 36, 33, 28. Grandchildren, 14, 12, 9, 5, 5, 3. I wondered if the 6 grandchildren, including what appeared to be a set of twins, were what made Mendy so fearful of death, or if there were other reasons like reveling still in horrors and sharp clothes. I should have asked people a lot of things that afternoon. But later, though regretting that I hadn't, I understood that to have gotten answers to any of my questions beginning whatever happened to would not have told me why I had the uncanny sense that what goes on behind what we see is what I was seeing. It didn't take more than one of the girls saying to the photographer the instant before he snapped the class photo, be sure and leave the wrinkles out. It didn't take more than laughing along with everyone else at the nicely timed wisecrack to feel that destiny, the most ancient enigma of the civilized world, and our first composition topic in freshman Greek and Roman mythology, where I wrote, the fates are three goddesses, called the Muri, Clotho who spins, Lachesis who determines its length, and Atropos who cuts the thread of life. Destiny had become perfectly understandable, while everything unenigmatic, such as standing for the photograph in the third row back with my one arm on the shoulder of Marshall Goldstein, children 39, 37, grandchildren 8, 6, and my other on the shoulder of Stanley Wernikoff, children 39, 38, grandchildren 5, 2, 8 months, had become inexplicable. A young NYU film student named Jordan Wasser, the grandson of fullback Milton Wassenberger, had come along with Milt to make a documentary of our reunion for one of his classes. From time to time, as I floated around the room to document the event in my own outdated way, I overheard Jordan interviewing somebody on camera. It was like no other school, 63-year-old Marilyn Koplik was telling him. The kids were great, we had good teachers, the worst crime we could commit was chewing gum. Best school around, said 63-year-old George Kirschenbaum. Best teachers, best kids. Mind for mind, said 63-year-old Leon Gutman, this is the smartest group of people I ever worked with. School was just different in those days, said 63-year-old Rona Siegler. And to the next question, Rona replied with a laugh without much delight in it. 1950? It was just a couple of years ago, Jordan. I always tell people, somebody was saying to me, when they ask if I went to school with you, how you wrote that paper for me in Wallach's class on Red Badge of Courage. But I didn't. You did. What could I know about Red Badge of Courage? I didn't even read it till college. No, you wrote the paper for me on Red Badge of Courage. I got an A+. I handed it in a week late, and Wallach said to me, it was worth waiting for. The person telling me this, a small, dour man with a close-clipped white beard, a brutal scar beneath one eye, and 2 hearing aids, was one of the few I saw that afternoon on whom time had done a job, and then some. On him, time had worked overtime. He walked with a limp and spoke to me leaning on a cane.
His breathing was heavy. I didn't recognize him, not when I looked squarely at him from 6 inches away, and not even after I read on his name tag that he was Ira Posner. Who was Ira Posner? And why would I have done him that favor? Especially when I couldn't have. Did I write the paper for Ira without bothering to read the book? Your father meant a lot to me, Ira said. Did he? I asked. In the few moments I spent with him in my life, I felt better about myself than the entire life I spent with my own father. I didn't know that. My own father was a very marginal person in my life. What did he do? Remind me. He scraped floors for a living, spent his whole life scraping floors. Your father was always pushing you to get the best grades. My father's idea of setting me up in business was buying me a shoe sign kit so I could give quarter shines at a newsstand. That's what he got me for graduation. Dumb fuck. I really suffered in that family. A really benighted family. I lived in a dark place with those people. You get shunted aside by your father, Nathan. You wind up a touchy fellow. I had a brother we had to put in an institution. You didn't know that. Nobody did. We weren't allowed even to mention his name. Eddie. 4 years older than me. He would go into wild rages and bite his hands until they would bleed. He would scream like a coyote until my parents quieted him down. At school, they asked if I had brothers or sisters. I wrote, none. While I was at college, my parents signed some permission form for the nut house, and they gave Eddie a lobotomy, and he went into a coma and he died. Can you imagine? Tell me to shine shoes on Market Street outside the courthouse? That's a father's advice to his son? So, what did you do instead? I'm a psychiatrist. It's your father I got the inspiration from. He was a physician. Well, not exactly. He wore a white coat, but he was a chiropodist. Whenever I came with the guys to your house, your mother always put out a bowl of fruit, and your father always said to me, what is your idea on this subject, Ira? What is your idea on that subject, Ira? Peaches, plums, nectarines, grapes. I never saw an apple in my house. My mother is 97. I got her in the home now. She sits there crying in a chair all day long, but I honestly don't believe she's any more depressed than she was when I was a kid. I assume your father's dead? Yes. Yours? Mine couldn't wait to die. Failure went through his head in a really big way. And still, I had no idea who Ira was or what he was talking about, because as much as I was remembering that day of all that had once happened, far more was so beyond recall that it might never have happened, regardless of how many Ira poses stood face to face with me attesting otherwise. As best I could tell, when Ira was in my house being inspired by my father, I could as well not have been born. I had run out of the power to remember even faintly my father's asking Ira what he thought while Ira was eating a piece of our fruit. It was one of those things that get torn out of you and thrust into oblivion just because they didn't matter enough. And yet, what I had missed completely took root in Ira and changed his life. So you don't have to look much further than Ira and me to see why we go through life with a generalized sense that everybody is wrong except us. And since we don't just forget things because they don't matter, but also forget things because they matter too much, because each of us remembers and forgets in a pattern whose labyrinthine windings are an identification mark no less distinctive than a fingerprint, it's no wonder that the shards of reality one person will cherish as a biography can seem to someone else who, say, happened to have eaten some 10,000 dinners at the very same kitchen table to be a willful excursion into mythomania. But then nobody really bothers to send in their $50 for a 45th high school reunion so as to turn up and stage a protest against the other guy's sense of the way it was. The truly important thing, the supreme delight of the afternoon, is simply finding that you haven't yet made it onto the in memoriam page. How long is your father dead? Ira asked me. 1969, 26 years, a long time, I replied. To whom? To him? I don't think so. To the dead, said Ira, it's a drop in the bucket. Just then, from directly behind me, I heard Mendy Gerlich saying to someone, who'd you jerk off over? Lorraine, a second man replied. Sure, everybody did. Me too. Who else? Said Mendy. Diane. Right, Diane. Absolute. Who else? Selma. Selma? I didn't realize that, Mendy said. I'm surprised to hear that. No, I never wanted to fuck Selma. Too short. For me, it was always twirlers.
watch him practicing up on the field after school, and then go home and beat off the pancake makeup, cocoa-colored pancake makeup on their legs, drove me nuts. You notice something? The guys on the whole don't look too bad. A lot of them work out, but the girls, you know. Now, 45th Reunion is not the best